Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Bitco is revolutionizing the way businesses connect. We're taking on your connectivity challenges and shooting our high-speed fiber internet across the country. Not just for some, but for everyone. Fiber is not a luxury, but a necessity. For business, for life, for you. And being connected is everything. So network with a Tier 1 internet provider and take your business to the next level of connectivity. Bitco.co.za. Connectivity is everything.
Thank you for listening to the Tech Central podcast. I'm Duncan MacLeod. I'm on a Skype call today with Sunny Fisher, founder of For Us Global Digital Exchange, for what I know is going to be a fascinating discussion on how the blockchain could transform the financial services industry by someone who's actually doing it. Welcome to the podcast, Sunny.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Now, we met last week, actually, and based on a discussion, I thought For Us would make a great discussion topic for a podcast. But before we get into what it is you're doing, you actually have a very interesting background, which includes forays into the point of sale market, where you were an early investor in SnapScan, and you were involved with APSA in the bidding for the social grants payment tender, which erupted into a major court battle after the deal went to NetOne's Cash Paymaster Services. But please tell us a bit more about Sunny Fisher and your background. I think you describe yourself as a world traveler.
Yeah, I think that's a good description. I've been sort of walking the earth for the last 8 years, living out of a suitcase. I've been to China, the US, Europe, the Caribbean, all in search of a solution to some of South Africa's problems. So, I'm a serial entrepreneur. I always cringe when I hear that phrase. I can't believe I said it, but in business since I was 15, you know, in the computer business. My background is in IT. I had a few IT businesses. I listed some. I sold some to listed companies. I sort of had a couple of good successes in the point of sale space, in inventory optimization, and in IT security. So sort of a very diverse background. And it was about 8 years ago that I got into banking, and that's when I developed a payment solution for APSA for the agri division and got into the whole social grant thing. And you know, that's when I saw this massive opportunity, this market that was being ignored by everybody. People were paying lip service at best. And you know, there are 3.5 billion people who don't have access to financial services. So you know, I think that for me, the definition of an entrepreneur is someone who has more balls than brains. So I thought, I'll tell you what, why don't I just start a competitor to Visa and MasterCard? How hard can that be?
Certainly ambitious, Sunny, certainly ambitious. But yeah. you were involved in the bidding for this SASSA social grants tender, and I know there was a lot of controversy around that, and it went all the way to the Constitutional Court in the end, if I'm not mistaken. But you left the country around that time. You mentioned to me last week that you were a bit disillusioned about that whole process. Tell us a bit about that and why you decided to leave.
Well, you know, I was working on that tender with Orpay, a division of APSA, and I was also working on Spaza Finance and coming up with a way to use technology and banking to provide small business loans, because that's you know, the most important thing we can do as a country. We have to give everybody access to capital, small businesses, whether it's a Spaza or a taxi. You know, you can't move forward in life without capital. Whether you're studying, it costs money. If you want to invest in your business, you need to buy equipment. You know, whether you're baking or selling tomatoes on the side of the road, or whether you're Anglo-American, you cannot grow without capital. and we have completely failed in our delivery of access to capital to the majority of the population. So when I got involved in it, I'm kind of a throw yourself into things kind of guy. So I did a lot of research and got really involved. And yeah, I've spent the last 8 years figuring out how to save South Africa from bankruptcy. Did that sound dramatic?
Well, you've been traveling for much of those last 8 years. You only recently returned to South Africa, is that right?
Yes. What happened was I realized that it's impossible to launch a payment platform from South Africa or Africa or anywhere other than the U.S. You know, having spent a couple of years there, I spent 3 years in Atlanta working in the payments industry. That's the payments capital of America. And I worked with the big banks, with U.S. Bank and with UnionPay. And then I moved to L.A. and worked with City National Bank and worked on how to monetize the entertainment industry. But what I was doing there in Atlanta, I was working with African-American churches and the banks. In L.A., I was working with the music industry, the artists who business model has fallen apart. And South African grant recipients, civil servants, and basically everybody in the banking system. So what I've done is I've put together a global consortium. In fact, we signed our manifesto a week ago. We had someone here from the Caribbean, from America, St. Martin, more specifically, America, Zimbabwe, South Africa, the cooperative banking industry. And basically, we've done a global black economic empowerment deal where we're creating a commerce and payment platform for the 99% because 99 is greater than 1. So we're taking the power back.
Okay, let's talk a bit about Forus. You've been working with a team of people on this for about 8 years now. Is that right?
Yeah, crazy, absolutely crazy.
Now it's meant to achieve true, and I'm quoting here, true financial inclusion where the banks haven't, and using blockchain technology to do it. Tell me a bit more about what exactly you've developed here.
So what we've developed is what we're calling a public utility blockchain. We've created a blockchain that is the first industrial strength one that can handle the response times that are required, not only for payments, which can be pretty intense. Visa and MasterCard in their peak periods do 10 to 15,000 transactions a second. But in the IoT world, that's not even going to be significant. I think Facebook, that they, I think there are 30 billion posts on Facebook a day.
Wow.
Yeah, you know, so it kind of, you know, the payments industry, they used to be the big boys, but now they're not. So I think there's an opportunity to create a digital aggregator, you know, a digital version of what Visa and MasterCard were designed to do, but they were designed before the internet. Mm. That's quite important to remember, because in the days when it was invented, the banks owned the networks, you know, the cables to the branches, to the ATMs. There was no public internet, so they didn't really think it was that important to encrypt anything.
Right.
If you invented that technology today, they'd sue you, you know. So it's actually impossible to secure. I know I did it for a living. I made a lot of money because, you know, all you can do is do your best and clean up afterwards.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are just so many holes. So now with blockchain and distributed ledgers, we solved that distributed data problem. Because the way it works at the moment, right, every organization that you do business with has got a server with a firewall keeping the bad guys out. And when anybody gets behind the firewall, it's a free fall because nobody stores data encrypted at rest, which is what you're supposed to do for PCI compliance, you know, for payment information. And you can see why people's identity and that information gets stolen all the time, because people don't store it and look after it properly. It costs money. It's complicated. And it only takes one mistake and, you know, there's a hole and someone finds it. So it's costly. It makes banking very slow. The compliance and fraud issues, it's like driving with a handbrake up. Where now we have technology where we can store everything in one place. So every organization can store their data in your smart contract. It's not behind a firewall. It's in the public domain. It's just encrypted. So it's secure but easy to access. Nobody has to open firewalls for anybody. Nobody needs to send secure information from pillar to post. So it's kind of like the SSL for mobile phones. We've now secured the data, and we can do now secure transactions on your mobile, because that's the frustrating thing, right? Everybody's got this powerful computer in their hand, but we're not really using it for secure transacting. Every app's got its own PIN code. You can do SIM swapping. It's like close but no cigar. So what we did was we said, look, we need to build for the digital world from the ground up. And we've built technology that creates a federated identity and a federated blockchain that everybody can share. So it's based on the model of Ubuntu, right? In Africa, we can't build infrastructure seven times. We must try and skip to the cutting edge and utilize the technology that's available. So it's like I say to people when they ask me, are we banking the unbanked? I said, no, why would you do that? It's like taking someone who's healthy and making them sick. We should unbank the banked. Because banking is an antiquated concept. You know, I think the whole world of banking and payments is set to change with the digital era, where you'll see payments and banking embedded in objects and apps and what have you. So, you know, for example, you'll be able to buy milk from your fridge, on your fridge. To do that, you need a security layer that works for everybody. So the whole industry is crying out for a standard so we can have secure transacting, authenticated and encrypted. So that was a very long answer to say that what we've done is we've created a place where everybody can store their data securely. It's immutable. It's there forever. There's seven instances of it around the world, so there's no single point of failure. We only need a consensus of four. And we've managed to build technology that can do the volumes of transactions on blockchain, which nobody's been able to do. We've had some really clever South African engineers. I traveled all over the world building the technology for this and different iterations and, you know, prototypes and what have you. But it was this, you know, bunch of South African guys who just the most amazing engineers who have done stuff with blockchain that I think people are going to be reading about it soon in the technical press. It's really, really impressive.
So what you've built here, is it purely a transactional platform or is it more than that?
You know, what is a transaction? Everything's a transaction, right? Mm-hmm. Opening your the boom at your gate with your phone is a transaction.
But are you, I mean, is this going to be a deposit-taking venture?
No, so it's just the exchange, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a digital exchange, so we can exchange money, we can exchange shares, we can exchange music and television. So when you're thinking digital, you know, we've got to get beyond the sort of just the Visa, MasterCard sort of thinking. It's a new paradigm. I call it smart money. You know, I think while everybody else has been trying to digitize banks, we realized that what you really want to digitize is money. So what you can do with blockchain is you can build intelligence with smart contracts into the money. So, for example, and again, just another random example, we're rolling out use cases over the next 4 months. But an example is you could have escrow money. And when anybody pays with that, the proof of delivery is built into the currency. And funds only change hands when that happens. So because you've got intelligence that you can build into the money that gets stored with the money, can't be changed, altered, and won't conclude until all the conditions have been met. That's more than, you know, it's a whole new paradigm. And I think that the O in for us stands for open. What we're doing is we're not an app. We're not a wallet. We're a platform where we're working with developers in all different kinds of fields, from insurance to point of sale to transport. A lot of people want to include seamless payments in their apps, but with Visa and MasterCard, it's really hard to do. In South Africa, only 20% of the people have cards that can be used online. You know, so there are all sorts of barriers, and we need to break that down. And, you know, just also for as a country, we need to do that. Our e-commerce volumes are 1/10 of the U.S. The biggest contributor is the lack of an online payment method, but the second biggest is deliveries. Mm-hmm. And now with peer-to-peer and, you know, the courier can find you, there are a million opportunities that open it up to smaller merchants. You don't have to be an Amazon anymore to be in the e-commerce space. And, you know, what we need to do as a country, as a continent, is position ourselves with our own e-commerce platform. In my view, the reason why China was so successful and one of the main contributors to them beating the U.S. was Alibaba. Because mm-hmm. you can buy Chinese goods from America. You can use an escrow service to pay. But you can't do that the other way around. So Chinese merchants aren't buying from American companies, but it certainly is happening the other way around. So we need an Alibaba for Africa. We need everybody to be able to get into the e-commerce space, to be able to transact, and to be able to do business digitally.
Do you see this as competition to what the banks are doing? Should the banks be worried about for us?
No, not at all. We're a platform for banks. So we partnered here with in South Africa with the cooperative banks, and we're with Standard Bank on the merchant acquiring side. We have an agreement with them, and we're negotiating with another South African bank to come on board. And in the US, we've integrated to thousands of banks. So it's very much a platform like Visa and MasterCard is for banks. Because banks have to make money. Also, it's part of our strategy. You know, the ubiquity has always been the focus of what we do. And I think they asked Willie May, the American bank robber, Willie, why do you keep robbing banks? And he said, well, that's because that's where they keep the money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's why we realized that you have to partner with the banks. You're not... You know, the financial services is highly regulated. There's massive capital investment. You know, you're not going to have an app like SnapScan and then bank the entire world. You know, it's just not going to happen. So you need a platform that brings the banks along. There's 75,000 banks in the MasterCard network, and we have some new revenue streams for them. It's a new way of doing banking. Our whole model is based on Plan B, which was developed by Richard Branson and Muhammad Yunus, and it's a B Corp. It's about people, planet, and profit, which is, you know, not the normal approach that you have from the commercial banks. Our lending model is friendly. We don't charge interest. It's all partnership based. If we lend money to someone who can't pay it back, we lose the money. Not, you know, they don't lose their home. It's our job to lend responsibly. So it's a whole social model. You know, it's a combination of cooperatives and I guess a collaborative. And it's a model that works well in Africa outside of financial services. The cooperative banks just haven't seemed to take off in South Africa, not since the Afrikaners pioneered it with, you know, Old Mutual and Volkskas and Sanlam and what we're doing is we're getting that movement going again and saying we need to provide our own capital because that's the key. That's what America did. That's what Germany did. Now, U.S. Bank used to be called the Bank of Italy because Italians couldn't get access to capital, so they started their own bank. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's, you know, that's – but to launch that, you need a platform, and you need something that's ubiquitous that all the merchants can access and that, you know, has tons of customers. So it's quite a challenge to get that part right. It's like organizing a big party.
Yeah. What was the old quote? I mean, if there's only one guy with a fax machine, what's the point? But when the world has fax machines, you can all communicate with each other. So how do you get this out? do you need all the banks working with you? Do you need e-commerce providers working with you? Do you need a critical mass before this is successful?
Yes, you absolutely need that. Otherwise, it won't work. And we're pretty confident that we'll have in excess of 100 million customers by March. And that was our targeted number to get past the tipping point. I think once you get there, people will use it because they have to, not because they're early adopters.
100 million, that's a stunning number. By March next year?
Yeah. You know, the important thing to remember is I've been doing this for 9 years.
Right.
So it's 3 months, but it's, you know, it's been 9 years. And yes, I've been working on the ground with large member organizations. Okay. You know, from churches to Stockvels to the banking industry, mm-hmm. to universities, unions, you know, banks, and certainly churches. So that's the only way you can do this, right? You can't send people up one by one. You need to get that bulk, those bulk numbers quickly.
Right, right. And all you need is a smartphone?
No, all you need is a phone or a card. It doesn't have to be smart. Mm-hmm. It can be, I think, is the. So we've got USSD and all of that because, you know, you have to include everybody. We also have a card because you need to be able to store value on the card for remote areas.
Right.
Otherwise, you can't replace cash. So we're kind of doing the Oyster card of Africa for chip that last mile.
Is that a chip card solution?
Correct.
All right. So are you 100 million customers or users by March next year would imply that you're not only going to focus on the South African market and you're going to try and internationalize this as quickly as possible. Which markets are you looking at first?
Yeah, so the biggest market by far for us will be the US.
Right.
So we've been doing payment processing in the US for a couple of years now. So we have a gateway there, and we do processing for churches. We have a lot of government contracts. Because we're a black woman-owned business, we get set-aside contracts from the federal government. But what the next step we're doing is we're actually registering a bank. So it'll be the first woman black-owned merchant acquiring bank. And we have millions and millions of church members and people in the African American community that we're signing up through the churches. You know, everyone goes to church every week in America and they tithe every week, and they're going to be using our platform. So that's gives us a nice critical mass to get going. It's one of those nice markets where you have a merchant and a customer that, you know, they arrive at the same time. So churches are a very big market for us, and they also become shareholders. So our first 200 million customers become shareholders in the platform, and that's, you know, we're using that as a method to create capital for people who haven't had it before. We're turning the pyramid on its head. So what we're saying is the new Visa and MasterCard, the shareholders are the poor people, and everyone else can pay to get access. Here's a chance for people who would never have been able to before to get them to participate before Goldman Sachs get in and before, you know, all the other guys, the wealthy people who get their chunk. We now are making sure that the people who don't have get this opportunity. And we believe that as this thing grows past our initial launch markets, it's going to become significantly valuable. If you think that Visa and MasterCard have a combined market capitalization in excess of $350 billion, mm-hmm. You know, I reckon if we have 200 million customers, our customers will have done well in terms of the share price. And then what we do is we give them the opportunity to borrow against that, and that provides the capital base. So, you know, this is more than just a payment platform. This is actually about the underlying problem, which is access to capital. So we're reversing them onto the Johannesburg Stock Exchange and also issuing a bond where we'll raise money to provide these working capital finance and small business loans.
Okay. So you've launched these services already. How long have they been available in the market, and where did you launch first?
No, so we haven't actually officially launched. What we did is as we went to every territory, we started up the platform, got everything connected, and turned it off. So I've been patiently waiting till I can see the whites of their eyes before we pull the trigger, because you can't get there incrementally. So we've been stuffing the pipe, stuffing the pipe, stuffing the pipe. People have been waiting patiently, but we weren't prepared to launch until we were certain that we had the 100 million in the bag. Because otherwise, I don't know if you know the story of Masada.
I don't.
When the Jews were on the top of the mountain, the Romans were building a ramp up to get to the top. And they had catapults up there, and the people kept going to the leader and saying, release the catapults. And he knew that the longer he waited, the better it was, because they kept building and he was going to break it down. So he went too soon, and they started rebuilding with a canopy, and they got to the top. If he'd waited a bit longer, they wouldn't have had time to get, you know, to the top. So it's like waiting patiently, having stuff that you want to launch, but it's not 100 million people, just having that discipline to say, you know, you just have to wait, because it's a bit like launching a rocket. You've got to get it out of that pull of the Earth's atmosphere. So we've got a whole sequence of rockets that are designed to just continue to grow the numbers. Because, this is a social engineering project almost, having to get, you know, change people's behavior. Because if you think about a payment method, they're all still in use today, every single one that was invented, you know, from coins to notes to checks, we still use it all. So to introduce a new payment method is like, it's probably easier to start a new religion. I don't know.
So
that's my plan B.
So who are the shareholders in for us, and what is the revenue model?
So the shareholders are basically management, myself and the rest of the team. We recently got some external investors. We raised $5 million from a local South African family who in the toiletry business in South Africa, Indian family. Mm-hmm. And which has been great, because it's given us access, you know, again to another whole community and who have their own needs. And it's quite cool, because our lending model is actually Sharia compliant, and we're in the process now of having it certified as Sharia compliant by the council. So, and our revenue model is advertising. Essentially, it's actually three things. We make money from advertising. We make money from lending. So we do interest-free loans, but we make some money doing that. Doing some very clever stuff in the background. And then we also have a crowdfunding sort of platform. And then we have Mahala TV, which is our digital advertising platform. So we've got a number of sort of businesses that create ecosystems themselves, all pulling together the digital economy. We're doing things that are easy to do when you're in the space. So, for example, when it comes to equity-based crowdfunding, you need to have a real-time settlement platform with no chargeback risk, mm-hmm. and you also need to have a blockchain to do the share transfer without being an exchange or needing an intermediary. So, you know, you've just bypassed, you know, three regulators because you don't have that need for a trusted party. So I think we're going to be disrupting a whole lot of industries, finding new revenue models, because our customers will do that, and the banks will do that, because, yes, we've done away with transaction fees, as Skype did. You know, we're talking now, we're not paying Skype anything, right?
Right.
So same thing, payments and banking will be free. It's the highway. You know, we can't tax people on that, because it excludes people. It makes it more expensive. I read somewhere where they were saying that if you can bring down the cost of doing business, the cost of transactions, by a couple of cents, it has a percentage impact on the GDP. So yeah, I think, you know, everybody can use the platform, and that's the thing. You know, banks might make money out of transaction revenue, but they also have, Standard Bank has $12 billion a year in IT costs.
Yeah,
which now will also go away. So, you know, those big industries with big capital investment. I guess it's like the automobile industry. You know, the big cost is not the cars; it's all the other infrastructure, the petrol stations and the roads and the, you know, so to go to electric, I heard it's something like a $280 trillion, you know, worth of infrastructure. And it's the same with the banks. They've got so much invested in this old infrastructure and they continue to perpetuate it, even though the cost is becoming increasingly high. So they're being left behind and not taking advantage of all the technological innovation because they have this sunk capital. But now with cloud computing and smartphones, that stuff isn't going to protect them anymore, and business models are overtaking them.
Okay. Now, South Africa has a very highly regulated financial services sector. What are some of the regulatory issues that you've had to navigate in launching the business locally?
It's interesting you say that, because I was reading, I think it was Cass Cavadia in MoneyWeb today, and was saying the same thing, that we have a very well-regulated financial services industry and the banks are sound and their balance sheets are sound and they're all within Basel III. And, you know, that's all good and well, but how do they make their money? They're microlenders. Like, they've got $150 billion in unsecured loans that they charge 40% to. Yes, of course they're healthy because they're stealing money from poor people. They also charge 600 million rand a month in bounce debit order fees and debit order fees. That's billions a year. That's also stealing. If you walked into someone's house and stole something, you'd go to jail. It's well regulated, but it's also fundamentally unfair. You know, who authorized these tracking debit orders? Because what we did was we had 6 million Mzansi accounts. I don't know if you remember, the government introduced these accounts, forced the banks to have these lower cost accounts.
Yes.
And it got to 6 million, and now it's basically no one uses it anymore because the debit orders, the microlenders, say you lose your job, your debit orders bounce. So now they hit you for everyone that bounces, it's $100. Now you're 1,000 rand overdrawn, and all the debit orders are sitting there waiting in the queue. You get a piece job so you can, you know, get some food for your family. You deposit the money in your bank account. Somebody's going to take it. You're not going to have a say. They just take it, and there's nothing you can do, and that's also not right. So I don't buy this whole, you know, regulated for who. The other thing about the regulated is also the technology has also changed that paradigm. So one of the things that the banking cartels have hidden behind is the balance sheet and the capital adequacy, because a couple of years ago in the late 80s, we had like 10 small banks. All of them had a run on the bank and they went under. So that's the defense. They're saying that one bad bank can create a run on the banking system. And that's why they don't want to issue banking licenses. But now with blockchain, that's no longer case, because you don't need a float, you don't need a settlement drift. So banks don't take floats, they can actually settle in real time.
Yeah.
So that systemic risk has fallen away. So, you know, a lot of that risk stems from, you know, the days of yore, and technology has improved it. I'll give you another example. They go through this whole FICA thing, right? You got to do this, you got to do that. It all falls down as soon as you get some guy who isn't going to comply with the system on that day, and that happens all the time. But in the digital world, I can, using artificial intelligence, compare whether your photo and your ID photo are the same person. I can check on Facebook who you are, who your friends are. There's absolutely no way you can create a false identity, and I won't pick it up. So why am I still asking for a utility bill? Because some bloody politician or regulator 25 years ago said you have to have a utility bill because that's the best way to stop money laundering. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're rallying against that kind of antiquated thinking. You can't fix today's problems with yesterday's tools.
But how does regulation in South Africa affect you directly? Do you have to have a financial services license to be able to operate?
Yes,
you do.
Absolutely, you do. We don't, because we're just the platform. But okay. The money is ultimately held by a bank. It's either a cooperative bank, registered and regulated by the government and the Reserve Bank, or in other countries we comply with their regulations. The same thing with foreign exchange controls, and they absolutely comply with everything: anti-money laundering, know your customer. There are plenty of syndicates out there who go to work every day. The guys put on a tie, go to the office, and their job is to steal credit cards and that kind of thing. So, you have to be constantly on the ball, and compliance is important. The other thing that makes us a little different is we don't do fractional lending, so we're not leveraging our balance sheet. We have a different model. It's far safer than the current banking system. We also have a deposit insurance, which you don't have in the South African banks. If Standard Bank went under, the government would probably step in because they want to, but they're not obliged to. Mm-hmm. In America, it's deposit insurance. We don't have that. On our platform, we do.
Sunny, take me through how this will work in practice. First of all, when will South African consumers be able to use this platform?
So we've got four distinct phases between now and March.
Okay.
So the first phase is sign up. So we're in that process at the moment. We're signing up thousands and thousands of people every day from all over the world.
Right.
Once we've achieved our number, we'll then turn on the banking and payment platform.
Okay.
That's phase two. Phase three is we turn on the lending platform. So we'll be doing our first loans, we're going to have billions of rands to lend out to small business. We also are busy with initiatives in the film space, so we're going to be doing film funding and agricultural funding. And so that phase is all about the lending. And then the last phase is the digital exchange. And it's at that point that people will be able to use our e-currency to pay anyone anywhere in the world real time.
So how will it work in practice? I'm a consumer. I've signed up for this now. Do I get sent a card? I install an app on my phone. If I want to make a payment to someone, it's all done digitally, I assume. Would I be able to use this platform at a retail point of sale, for example, to buy goods?
Absolutely. So you won't get sent a card, because one of the things that makes cards expensive is that the for Visa and MasterCard, you have to get the card securely in the person's hands with the PIN.
Yes.
That's where a lot of fraud happens. With our system, we don't do that. It's just not necessary. You can pick your card up at the retailer or at your club or at your church or wherever, and then you can just link it to your account so you can use any card. We have an app. And you can also do it on USSD. So it's your basic payments, money transfers. You can shop. We have a mag stripe on the card, so you can swipe it and put in your PIN at the big box retailers. So it basically works no different to your banking now, except at the moment, let's use the example of Uber, SnapScan, and your card. At the moment, those are three different companies really providing the payments for all of that. We're one company that does that all.
Are there limits to the size of the transactions you can do?
No.
So you can – and there are no charges associated with this at all. So you could load the card with money. Someone can give you money. You could transfer money into an account like this. And then you could go to a retailer and spend any amount of money and not pay any transaction fees at all. Is that right?
That is correct.
Yeah, I can see this being quite disruptive. but you're going to have to work with retailers, I presume, to be able to do this at their point of sale.
Yeah. That was the easiest sell.
Yeah.
Because in the fast-moving consumer goods retailers, like Pick n Pay, probably makes 6% net.
Right.
So the 1.5 they're paying to Visa, MasterCard's significant. And in fact, in their last results on the front page of the Business Day, they were, when their results came out, they were complaining about the interchange fees.
I saw that.
So, yeah, that was a, you know, for them it's a no-brainer. They're not getting value. They resent it, and there's big pushback. And the minute there's an alternative, I think we can start shorting Visa and MasterCard stock.
So have you signed agreements with major retailers here in South Africa already?
Yes.
Can you say with who?
Some of the big box ones. We'll be making the announcements, but you know, all the colors.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So, that's the reason why we did the deal with Eccentric, which is part of Standard Bank.
Yeah.
They already do the acquiring for all of these guys, so it's a fairly simple implementation.
Okay. Now, you're going to be basing your operations, I'm not sure if it's your global operations or your South African operations, out of Port Elizabeth, which is an interesting choice. So one doesn't really think of Port Elizabeth as a center for technological innovation. I know there's a big car industry there, but I certainly don't think of it as a place where IT companies and fintech companies come from. Why did you choose Port Elizabeth specifically?
Actually, a couple of reasons. Things sort of came together, I think, on a sort of kind of a metaphysical level. It's the home of Nelson Mandela. There's something about that area that seems to be a catalyst for change. But what you actually have in Port Elizabeth is something that in America they use Aspen. And I was going to use Curacao in the Caribbean. What do these cities all have in common? It's very easy to get ubiquity. They're 10-minute cities. Port Elizabeth, we already have the students. We issue the student cards for the university, and we have a deal with the taxis. All we need to do to get ubiquity is sign up the merchants in town, and you can do that with 10 reps. If you send them in 10 different directions, you'll be done in a day or two. And then you can make sure that everybody in that town is on the system, and that's what you need. You can't do that in Joburg or Cape Town. It's just too big.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're doing is we're turning we're driving a smart city initiative. So we want to take advantage of this unique environment that they have and turn it into a laboratory city.
Okay.
So we're going to do everything smart there. It's going to be the first cashless city in Africa, and we're going to see how we can utilize technology to drive not only innovation, but also things like interaction with government, using technology to make it easy to interact with government, not these stupid websites but apps. And so, it's going to be a big test bed for that. And part of the fund that we've put together, we're going to be funding businesses if they base themselves there. So we're going to provide the best incentive there is, which is funding, to create a bit of an innovation hub. The university there is amazing. We're working with a number of different departments on projects. PE and Mandela University are probably at the cutting edge of alternative energy in South Africa. And, I tell the story that there's originally there was the wool exchange in PE. It was the biggest wool exchange outside of Liverpool. Then they got into ostriches, and there was the feather exchange. So where better to put the global digital exchange than in Port Elizabeth?
So are you going to be all your infrastructure going to be based there? Are you going to
That's where the foundation is based. We're certainly going to have lots of infrastructure there. But in today's world, you have to be everywhere, and most people are mobile anyway. So we're pretty lean. Our model is to partner and to license and to integrate. So we don't aspire to have 50,000 employees. I'll be spending my time back in the Caribbean now that we're about to go live. St. Martin got devastated by Hurricane Irma.
Yeah.
So that's one of the projects that we're going to be working on as well, is turning St. Martin into a smart island.
Okay. This is obviously going to be a very low-margin business, I'd imagine.
Yes. Indeed.
You mentioned the foundation, and is that the organization that the first 200 million customers will get shares in?
Yes, so it's not shares so much as it's a trust, and then the trust has shares in the listed company.
Okay.
But the foundation's there to keep this thing going in perpetuity, so that it keeps it out of the hands of the evil people.
Who are they? If I may ask.
I don't know. I'll let you fill in the blank. You know? And the ones we know and the ones we don't know.
Okay.
So we try to create an organization that'll continue beyond us. We've created a trust to fund it in a revenue stream.
Mm.
So it runs this for the good of everybody. It's like the highway, you know.
Mm.
And we're putting 20% of our top line revenue into the foundation. It's going to be a significant amount of money. And we're putting that into infrastructure to rolling this out. The sooner we get the 3.5 billion people active and transacting and being part of the global economy, the sooner we can have prosperity and eradicate poverty. This is the answer.
So you're not building this to sell it, to flip it to a MasterCard or Visa?
You know, I would flip it. And I have, you know, a couple of other projects I'm working on, which I think are also going to be a little disruptive. But, the way that we've designed it and the foundation, the core of it can't go anywhere. So we kind of did an interesting model. I modeled it on OpenID. Most people don't know the OpenID Foundation, but that's why you're able to log in with Facebook or Google or LinkedIn.
Yes.
Because there's a common identity that is your link in your keychain.
Mm.
And what they did was they made it a foundation, and then the guys who developed it created a separate business called Jan Rain, and then they just built technology around it. And because they were, you know, had developed it, they knew what to do. And that became their commercial venture. I deliberately set about the same strategy. So we've got the nonprofit that looks after the blockchain and also the actors, keeps the bad actors out, the regulatory stuff, all of compliance and all of that done through the foundation. And also we'll be driving a lot of the loans, the interest-free loans.
So it's a bit like it's a bit like the model that Mozilla created, the company that develops Firefox.
Yeah.
Similar sort of idea. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How much does it cost you to build this? I mean, what sort of investments are you making in this? And is it all self-funded? I mean, you mentioned the $5 million you raised from the South African family, but it doesn't sound like this is a particularly cheap venture.
No, it's cost me 2 wives, 4 houses, a partridge and a pear tree. The financial, I mean, you can imagine working on something this long and patiently waiting for revenue costs a lot.
Yeah.
And it's been tough because, you know, I just wasn't prepared to take shortcuts because you get short-term traction and then it doesn't work. So. It cost a lot, millions, in excess of $10 million has gone into this over the last 8 years. And the sweat of, you know, the most amazing people all over the world. The story has to be told, but it's not tens of people, it's hundreds of people who've, you know, contributed, you know, from some of the biggest companies in the world. I managed to full push, cajole my way into a lot of boardrooms,
mm-hmm.
you know, from JP Morgan to US Bank to Cox Communications, Qualcomm. I was convinced if I just told the right person the story, they would jump on board and help make it happen. But actually what I found was that everybody wants it to happen, but nobody wanted to be the one to make it happen.
Okay. You mentioned a listing. Just tell us a bit more about that. Is that going to be on the JSE or another board?
Yes. Yeah, it's going to be on the JSE. We will be listing on secondary markets through depository notes because our model is for our customers to be shareholders in their countries. And that's also how we're building this exchange, the e-currency exchange. So, we need to capitalize it. It's been capitalized on the cooperative banking model where the customers put the money in and then they own it.
Okay. And do you have a time frame on that listing? When are you looking at doing it?
We signed the agreements last night. So as soon as we comply with the necessary and the JSE and cautionaries and what have you, we'll be making an announcement soon.
Oh, wow. So it's a 2018 project, is it?
It's not the end of the year yet. Come on.
You really are ambitious, Sonny.
Listen, I'm in a hurry. It's been so long and I need a holiday.
So you'd list on the Alt-X, would you, or on the main board?
No, the main board. This is going to be a substantial – we'll have a market cap in excess of $5 billion.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I look forward to reading the prospectus and seeing more detail. Just lastly, before I let you go, Sonny, I know this is aimed at financial inclusion, to get particularly to help poor people. But do you think the upper end of the market will also use it?
Absolutely. Coming back to South Africa – I developed SnapScan. The first version was called Mahala, and then I left to America and sold out, and the guys did the deal with Standard Bank. But it's amazing how many people tell me that SnapScan is their favorite app.
Right.
I don't know if you've used it.
I use both SnapScan and Zappa all the time.
Right. So does that answer your question? I mean, if it was available in more places online and in person, you'd use it more. So for the bank people, it's about the convenience.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, my God, if I have to put my credit card details into one more website, I swear I'm going to kill someone.
Oh, I wanted to ask you, do you follow the work that Vinnie Lingham is doing at Civic?
I do.
He's building that blockchain-based method for secure identity. So you manage your own identity, and the idea is that it will do away with fraud, because you don't have to give all your identity information away to a company just because you want to transact with them, for example. Is there an opportunity to work with Vinnie and Civic and companies like that in what you're doing here?
It's difficult. One wants to collaborate on a platform like this as much as possible.
Yeah.
But I think when it comes to identity, it's difficult. It's almost like there can be only one.
Right.
Because it's all about who issues the keys and the security around that. So I think that what I've realized in the whole identity space is it's not a viable model. That's where I started. The first solutions I was looking for two-factor authentication for internet banking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a similar kind of thing. Nobody's going to ever pay for that. I don't know that the customers are going to drive the adoption. What we're doing to get adoption is we launched the Sunshine Sweepstakes. So we're going to be giving away hundreds of millions in prizes. I have no shame. We will do whatever it takes to get 100 million customers onto the platform. But I think that people are not motivated by security. People don't know that their current banking systems are not secure. If they knew just how much fraud went on, they'd have a heart attack. But they don't care. As long as money gets where it needs to go, nobody cares. Same thing with identity. It's very hard to motivate people to act in their own best interest. You almost have to trick them.
Great, Sonny. I think we could talk all day about.
We should probably
wrap it up there. But maybe let's look at doing a follow up next year, maybe around the listing or post launch, and have a look at the take up and how it's doing. But this really has been a fascinating discussion. I look forward to chatting again in future. Sonny Fisher is founder of 4US Global Digital Exchange. Thank you for talking to Tech Central today.
Thank you.